What does a philosopher who died 2,400 years ago have to say about your last breakup? More than you'd think. Alain de Botton's The Consolations of Philosophy isn't another dusty academic text. It's a survival guide disguised as intellectual history. Since its 2000 publication, this book has quietly revolutionized how we think about applying ancient wisdom to contemporary life. Emma Watson credited it with transforming her worldview. Academics praised its rare gift, making philosophy accessible without dumbing it down. De Botton's radical premise is simple yet profound. The greatest thinkers in history weren't pondering abstract puzzles. They were wrestling with the same fears, frustrations, and heartaches that keep you awake at 3 a.m. What if the cure for your anxiety, your loneliness, your sense of inadequacy has been sitting on library shelves for millennia, waiting for someone to translate it into language that speaks to your life right now? Facing 500 Athenian jurors in 399 BCE, Socrates chose death over apologizing for his philosophical questioning, not from martyrdom, but as the logical conclusion of a life spent understanding what truly matters. Every society operates on unexamined assumptions. Ancient Athens enforced rigid norms, specific dress codes, mandatory animal sacrifices, slavery, women stripped of property rights. Questioning these seemed as absurd then as interrogating our beliefs about career success might seem today. Short, bald, with a face compared to a crab, Socrates wandered Athens asking uncomfortable questions. His method was devastatingly simple. Find a confident statement, imagine it's false, seek exceptions, refine the definition. When generals claimed courage meant advancing in battle, he cited how Spartans won at Plataea by retreating strategically. His insight cuts through time. Authorities holding centuries-old beliefs may be wrong simply because they've never examined them logically. Accused of corrupting youth and religious impiety, Socrates was convicted by 56% of jurors. Yet he remained calm, because what matters isn't how many people oppose you, but their reasons for doing so. Athens later erected a bronze statue in his honor, proof that unpopularity might signal integrity, not failure. A philosopher famous for pursuing pleasure lived on bread, vegetables, and water, requesting only a pot of cheese for special occasions. This contradiction embodies Epicurus's radical insight. We're spectacularly bad at knowing what will make us happy. We believe we need Georgian houses, private jets, Italian villas, enough wealth to live on the interest of the interest. Yet determining what genuinely satisfies us is as difficult as diagnosing illness without medical training. Epicurus believed philosophy should function like medicine for the soul, helping us evaluate desires rationally. After careful analysis, he concluded happiness requires three surprisingly inexpensive ingredients. First, friendship. At 35, Epicurus established an unconventional household in Athens, sharing a large house with friends. We don't exist unless there is someone who can see us existing, he recognized. Friends confirm our identity through small comments and teasing, accepting our foibles, and giving us a place in the world. They pull us from numbness, understanding our fears when others respond with puzzled incomprehension. Second, freedom. Epicurus and his friends removed themselves from commercial employment, establishing a commune outside Athens where they grew vegetables. The wise man chooses not the greatest quantity of food, but the most pleasant, he explained. Living simply, they ceased judging themselves on material terms. Third, thought. For Epicurus, rational analysis was among the best remedies for anxiety. By writing down problems or discussing them, we allow their essential aspects to emerge. In the garden, as his community became known, thinking was continuously encouraged through conversation with intelligent, sympathetic companions. Epicurus divided needs into three categories: natural and necessary, friends, freedom, thought, basic sustenance; natural but unnecessary, grand houses, banquets; and neither natural nor necessary, fame, power. Happiness depends on psychological goods, but is relatively independent of material ones beyond basic necessities. Our confusion is aggregated by idle opinions, emphasizing luxury over friendship, freedom, and thought, opinions often promoted by commercial enterprises associating superfluous objects with our forgotten deeper needs. When Emperor Nero ordered Seneca's death in 65 AD, the philosopher faced forced suicide with equanimity, asking his weeping companions where their philosophical resolve had gone. Despite tuberculosis, depression, exile, and political peril, Seneca credited philosophy with enabling him to withstand these trials. Every frustration shares a fundamental structure, the collision of a wish with unyielding reality. Seneca believed wisdom comes from learning not to aggravate this collision through destructive emotional responses, rage, self-pity, anxiety, bitterness, and paranoia. Consider anger, which Seneca viewed as the ultimate infantile collision with reality. We rage when reality violates our entitled expectations. Seneca's solution? We will cease to be so angry once we cease to be so hopeful. When disaster struck, Seneca reminded survivors that no place on earth is exempt from fortune's reach. We dangerously form expectations based on probability rather than possibility. He prescribed daily premeditatio, morning meditation on potential sorrows. Reckon on everything, expect everything. For anxiety, Seneca rejected traditional reassurance. Instead, he advised acknowledging that bad things probably will happen, but recognizing they'll rarely be as terrible as we fear. When his friend Lucilius faced a career-destroying lawsuit, Seneca advised, "If you wish to put off all worry, assume that what you fear may happen is certainly going to happen." This rational examination typically reveals our anxieties exceed the actual problems. Our responses to noise measure our inner levels of self-friendship. Seneca described living near a gymnasium with continuous racket, grunting exercisers, panting weightlifters, massage slaps, revelers, vendors. Those unfriendly with themselves believe the builder is hammering specifically to annoy them. The wise interpretation separates causation from correlation. Human ingenuity arises from the question, does it have to be like this? The Romans exemplified productive refusal of frustration, developing underfloor heating, paving roads, building aqueducts. Yet these same mental faculties continue imagining change even when reality cannot be altered. Wisdom lies in correctly discerning where we're free to mold reality and where we must accept the unalterable with tranquility. The Stoics compared our condition to dogs tied to an unpredictable cart. Our leash gives us some freedom, but not unlimited movement. Unlike the dog, however, humans possess reason, allowing us to anticipate necessity. Our freedom lies not in controlling external events, but in choosing our attitude toward them. Our bodies hold our minds hostage, our entire perspective altered by something as simple as digestion. Montaigne invites us to imagine even Plato struck by epilepsy or needing to fart during a symposium. From his circular library in southwestern France, surrounded by 1,000 volumes, Montaigne harbored profound reservations about intellect's benefits. His library beams bore inscriptions like, "The happiest life is to be without thought." Rather than waging civil war against our bodies, Montaigne advocated reconciliation. The most uncouth of our afflictions is to despise our being. This wisdom proves valuable for anyone experiencing sexual dysfunction. The problem isn't physical, but psychological. The oppressive notion that we should maintain complete mental control over our bodies creates wordless shame. Montaigne's frankness liberates us. Traveling 3,000 miles through Europe in 1580, Montaigne observed how sharply notions of normality varied. What annoyed him were firm, unexamined convictions that one's own system was superior. Society assumes clever people should excel at academic questions. Yet Montaigne distinguished between learning, logic, grammar, and wisdom, knowledge that helps one live well. Education focused on making students learned rather than wise. We work merely to fill the memory, leaving the understanding and the sense of right and wrong empty. rebuking, laughing, buying, selling, loving, hating, and living together gently and justly were more remarkable achievements than society's glittering deeds. When love ends, we feel fundamentally broken. Arthur Schopenhauer, philosophy's great pessimist, offers unexpected consolation through his unflinching analysis of romantic attachment. Born in 1788, Schopenhauer developed a gloomy outlook early. After his father's apparent suicide, he inherited wealth yet found no comfort. His masterpiece sold only 230 copies. Skeptical of marriage, he remarked, "To marry means to do everything possible to become an object of disgust to each other." Schopenhauer recognized our rational minds serve our bodies through what he called the will to life, an inherent drive to survive and reproduce. This explains why even cerebral individuals fall for strangers or melt at gurgling infants. Love's intensity matches its function, deciding the composition of the next generation. We fall for specific people because our will to life seeks ideal co-parents. Beneath casual conversation, our unconscious assesses reproductive compatibility. Since we're imperfect, we're attracted to people whose imperfections cancel out our own, what Schopenhauer called neutralization. Short women fall for tall men. Feminine men are drawn to boyish women. This leads to Schopenhauer's bleakest conclusion. The person ideal for producing our child is rarely suitable for our own happiness. The will to life blinds us temporarily, then abandons us once its reproductive aims are achieved. Despite these unflattering explanations, Schopenhauer offers consolation for rejection. Our pain is normal. A force powerful enough to push us toward child-rearing cannot vanish without devastation. Rejection doesn't mean we're unlovable. We were simply unfit to produce a balanced child with that particular person. We should forgive our rejectors, as the breakup wasn't their choice, but an unconscious verdict. Friedrich Nietzsche rejected philosophy's traditional goal of reducing suffering. Instead, he declared, we should increase suffering and make it worse than it has ever been. This wasn't always his view. At 21, Schopenhauer taught him that wisdom meant accepting fulfillment's impossibility and seeking freedom from pain. Everything changed in autumn 1876 during a stay in Sorrento, where warm climate and intellectual conversation shifted his philosophy toward embracing existence. By year's end, Nietzsche announced his conversion. True fulfillment required recognizing pain's essential role in achieving anything worthwhile. His changed outlook came from studying historically fulfilled lives, his Übermenschen. Despite their darkness, they possessed courage, ambition, dignity, and independence. Such lives were impossible without misery. What if pleasure and displeasure were so tied together that whoever wanted to have as much as possible of one must also have as much as possible of the other? We suffer because fulfillment cannot be mastered spontaneously. Behind Montaigne's essays and Stendhal's masterpieces lay colossal struggles. Nietzsche found a metaphor in the Fex Valley, a fertile valley created by a terrifying glacier, proving savage forces can enable later civilization. What matters isn't difficulties themselves, but our response. Nietzsche proposed viewing difficulties as gardeners do. One can dispose of one's drives like a gardener and cultivate the shoots of anger, pity, curiosity, vanity, as productively and profitably as a beautiful fruit tree. We shouldn't feel embarrassed by our difficulties, only by failing to grow anything beautiful from them.